It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A Mega Millions lottery ticket sold in South Carolina is worth more than $1.5 billion. That's billion with a B after Tuesday's drawing. Needless to say, no one on this crew is the winner. Today on the Morning Show, we'll consider the history of the lottery, how jackpots get so big, and we'll talk about who really benefits from those lottery profits. Did you buy a lottery ticket for the Mega Millions drawing? Why or why not? Do you regularly buy lottery tickets? Again, why do you buy them or why don't you? What do you think the lottery money should be used for? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the phone number to call to join our discussion. You can also send us an email. The address is ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Liberty Vittert is a statistician and visiting assistant professor in statistics at Washington University in St. Louis. She's also the author of the recent piece published before the lottery drawing in The Conversation. The Mega Millions jackpot is now more than $1 billion. Where does all that lottery profit really go? Liberty, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So when lotteries first started, what was the goal?
Well, for most states, the way the public was promised that lottery money would be used is to fund public education. And that was sort of how we were sold, this idea that states would run a lottery. Actually, Wisconsin is very different, though, than most states. And actually, all revenue goes to property tax relief for residents. So Wisconsin is a little bit different of a story. But in general, most states, this is an idea that this would help the public, help our children, and fund public education.
So how has that changed?
Well, you know, interestingly, it hasn't. In fact, it is true that it funds public education. But the tricky part and the sneaky part is that it's not additional funding for public education. We thought our schools or education would be better. But really, it's just been underwriting the budget. So it's almost this bait and switch where we think it's going to make our education so much better. But really, in effect, it just becomes a tax like anything else. And even for Wisconsin, which is property tax relief, it still is a tax in effect.
And it's, well, how have we seen the number of Americans playing the lottery change over the years?
Well, per capita, the number of people playing has decreased. So in the 70s, about 70 to 80% of people played, and now only about half of Americans really play the lottery. So it means the lottery runners need to make more money from less people. And it's ended up creating this need and this drive to have our jackpots get bigger and bigger. Because we know that as the jackpots get bigger and bigger, we talk about them. It's in the news. People all of a sudden go, who would never, ever have bought a ticket, will go and buy one. For example, I clearly didn't win, but I bought a ticket. And I think I probably bought 3 or 4 lottery tickets in my life. But on Tuesday, I was right there at my 7-Eleven buying a lottery ticket.
What's the demographic of lottery players like these days?
Well, that would be this argument that the tax that we, you know, this idea that the lottery is an effective tax is actually really a tax on the poor. People in the lowest earning income bracket spend about $412 a year on the lottery, and that's compared to people who are the highest earners who only spend about $100 a year. So the poor spend 4 times on average the amount of their own money on the lottery than the rich do. And so really it's probably pretty fair to say that the lottery is effectively a tax on the poor.
And that was one of the criticisms, one of the arguments against the lottery to begin with, was that it was really a kind of a sneaky way to put a tax on the poor and the elderly, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and I think that's a very fair argument. And also, you know, what's very worrisome is that, you know, since this lottery money really funds the budget, you know, it underwrites this education budget in most states, it sort of puts this onus and this, sort of a need on legislatures to have the lottery keep going. All of a sudden, the state legislatures are, you know, indebted and sort of in need of this lottery to continue. And I think it really questions whether they're making the best decisions for the public.
Well, let's take the Mega Millions drawing this week. The winning ticket sold in South Carolina is worth more than $1.5 billion. It started at $40 million in July. That's a lot of money. What's behind these big jackpots?
So in 2017, pre-2017, you pick five numbers between 1 and 75, and then you picked one number between 1 and 15. But in 2017, that changed. And what they did was they made it easier to match the five numbers. So instead of picking a number between 1 and 75, you'd pick the five numbers between 1 and 70. So it's easier to match. But what they did then was they made that one number, that final number you choose. It was originally between 1 and 15, and now you pick a number between 1 and 25. So it's harder to match that one number, which means more people are getting these five numbers right. It's easier to get the five numbers right, meaning you win something. There's more small prizes. But it's a lot harder to match that one number, so it's a lot harder to get that huge jackpot. And what that means is the jackpot keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. However, more people win smaller prizes. So that means, you know, Joe Schmo down the street tells his friend, who tells his friend, who tells his friend, I won. People think, well, I could win because I knew somebody, somebody that did. And it means more people play. The lottery gets bigger. We talk about it. And more people buy tickets, making these huge, huge jackpots and enormous money for the state education fund.
So how much, roughly, do states profit from the lottery?
Well, we spend, as Americans, $73 billion a year on the lottery tickets, which is a little bit less than we spend on beer. And I would probably say beer would be your better bet, more bang for your buck. But in general, it varies state to state. In some states, very few, but some states don't even have a lottery. But for example, in Wisconsin, it was about $4 billion of property tax credits that were given to the state.
And in addition to these national lotteries, the Powerball and the Mega Millions, a lot of states have their own smaller lotteries, scratch games, and that kind of thing. Do we, the numbers you were just giving for lottery profits, does that include that, or would those be additional?
That is including all these little, you know, from the tiny little scratch cards all the way up to the Mega Millions and the Powerball. It is all included as the state lottery fund.
So, you say that how many jurisdictions are dividing up these lottery profits?
Well, that's what's really interesting is that some states have still decided not to be a part of this. But overall, there's 46 lottery jurisdictions. 44 of them are states, and then you have the U.S. Virgin Islands and Washington D.C. So it just shows you how much money we're really spending that even something like even one individual state takes in $4 billion from this.
So on balance, then, taking a look at the history of the lottery and everything we've talked about, is lottery money a good thing for a state or a bad thing?
I think this what it's turned into really begs the question about whether it's a good thing. And I think no one can argue that this is not, in effect, a tax on the poor. You may not agree with whether that's a bad thing or not, but it certainly is, in effect, a tax on the poor. And it also is beholden state legislatures to continuing the lottery, given that it does fund a percentage of the budget. And I think there is no doubt that this is a question that Americans have been dealing with for a long time, all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who said, the lottery really is a voluntary tax.
Liberty Vittert, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Liberty Vittert is a statistician and visiting assistant professor in statistics at Washington University in St. Louis. Coming up next, a statewide Amber Alert is in effect right now as officials and volunteers search for a missing Barron County teenager. Our next guest from the Wisconsin Department of Justice joins us to explain exactly how these Amber Alerts work. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Wisconsin is under a statewide Amber Alert following the disappearance of a Barron County teenager earlier this month. Wisconsin's Amber Alert plan is a collaborative effort between the Wisconsin Department of Justice, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, Wisconsin Public Radio, the Dane County Public Safety Communications Center, the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Revenue, Division of Lottery, and local law enforcement agencies. We're going to talk about the criteria and process for Amber Alerts, which are issued to help with the recovery of abducted children. What questions do you have about the Amber Alert system? Now's the time to ask them. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jennifer Price is commander of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Child Abduction Response Team and director of the Department of Justice Division of Criminal Investigation Special Operations Bureau. Jennifer, thank you for being with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is the Amber Alert?
So that's a great question. It actually was started in 1996 in memory of Amber Hagerman, who was abducted and murdered in Arlington, Texas. And following that, every state has since developed their own Amber program. And in Wisconsin, our program was created in April of 2003. So we've had it around for quite some time. And Amber is actually an acronym for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response, to really highlight how we use the emergency alerting system to alert the public to help us locate the missing child.
So it was created then to help find missing children. How often has it been used in Wisconsin?
We have had now a total of 35 Amber Alerts in Wisconsin since the inception in 2003.
But what are the criteria that are considered when deciding whether to issue an Amber Alert?
That's a good question, and they're very simple criteria. The first is that the child is age 17 or younger. The second is that the child is in danger of death or serious bodily harm. And the third is that there's enough information for us to disseminate to the public that would assist in finding the child. And the thing to remember, I think that there's sometimes maybe a misunderstanding that we have to have a suspect description or we have to have a suspect vehicle in order to issue an Amber Alert, and that's not true. If we have enough descriptive information about the child to be able to disseminate to the public that would assist in finding that child, that third criteria is met. And oftentimes we have enough information about the child, right, because we're in touch with local law enforcement. They've had a report of the missing child, so we're going to have enough information about that child. We'll know the child is age 17 or younger. So usually it's that third criteria in making a determination if the child is in danger of death or great bodily harm that will often determine whether or not we issue the Amber Alert.
And there, what are some of the more common, you mentioned a couple of them, but what are some of the more common misconceptions about the Amber Alert?
Well, I think it really just comes down to that set criteria for whether the child is in danger of death or great bodily harm that I think sometimes people believe that if a parent takes a child that there cannot be an Amber Alert, which is not true. If we have information that we believe that child is in danger, regardless of the person who took that child, we will issue an Amber Alert.
So take us through the process of issuing an Amber Alert. How does it start? How does the information flow? How does it get out to the public?
So it really starts with local law enforcement reaching out to the Dane County Public Safety Communication Center. Once local law enforcement has made a determination that they believe that their missing child fits the criteria for an Amber Alert, they will reach out to Dane County. And then Dane County Public Safety Communication Center will reach out to DOJ. And we here at the Division of Criminal Investigation have a supervisor on call 24/7, 365 to answer those calls. And then we'll evaluate each case as it comes in. We'll evaluate the facts. And then we have a number of people who are involved in the issuance of the Amber Alert so that we can push out the alerting in a number of different areas as quickly as possible. So the Dane County Public Safety Communication Center will send out the Amber Alert through the emergency alerting system. And there's 8 alerts that will go out for any Amber Alert, one every 30 minutes for the first 2 hours, and then every hour for the following 3 hours. And then while Dane County is working on the emergency alerting system, I will work with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to issue the wireless emergency alert. And that's called the WEA, the W-E-A, and that's the alert that we all get on our cell phones. So everybody in the state would have gotten the wireless alert last week, Monday, when we issued the alert for Jamie Kloss. And while that's going on, we have another person through our Missing and Exploited Persons Unit at the Division of Criminal Investigation who is working to send out the Wisconsin Crime Alert through our Wisconsin Crime Alert Network. So a number of your listeners may already be subscribers to the Wisconsin Crime Alert Network, and they would have gotten that notification by email or text. And then lastly, we work with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation to ensure that the Amber Alert is placed on the digital highway signs, and then the lottery will place the Amber Alert on their terminals throughout their outlets in Wisconsin. And then, I'm sorry, there is one last portion, and that is posting the missing child on our Amber Alert website, which is amberalertwisconsin.org. So as you can see, we have a number of different people working on a single Amber Alert at the same time. So we don't have one person, one group, or within one agency working on all of those different parts, because there's a lot of moving parts, and we want to make sure that we get those notifications out.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to this. I think most people would have no clue how that what goes on in the background. Jennifer Price is commander of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Child Abduction Response Team and director of the DOJ Division of Criminal Investigation Special Operations Bureau. We're talking about the Amber Alert. Jennifer, how do you determine whether to issue an Amber Alert regionally or statewide?
It's based on the factors in each particular case that we will consider, things such as the place the child was last seen, the time since the child went missing until the time that we received the request for the Amber Alert, a mode of transportation if we believe that the child is in a vehicle with the individual, or if we don't know, we'll take all of those factors into consideration in determining whether we issue in a region or multiple regions or statewide. So, for example, if we issue an Amber Alert in one or two, for example, in our EAS alerting regions in Wisconsin, and then as time goes on and we still have not located the child and we have reason to believe that the child is traveling through other parts of the state, we can actually increase those regions as we go through the alerting, through those 8 alerts that I previously described, so that if we issue in a particular region, that doesn't mean that through the course of the 8 alerts that we will only issue in those regions. So even though we issue an alert in the Eau Claire region, for example, if 2 hours go by and we believe that the child might be moving to other parts of the state, we'll expand those regions as appropriate.
So what should someone do if they think they have information regarding an Amber Alert?
Well, if they have information on an active Amber Alert, they should always call 911. That's an emergency that needs to be addressed immediately. If they believe that they see that child, local law enforcement needs to be notified. If they have information, for example, in our current Amber Alert that they want to share, they don't see the child, they don't see Jamie, but they have information that might lead to us finding Jamie, we have a tip line set up. If they have questions about the Amber Alert in general, they can always call us at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and we'd be happy to answer those questions.
You mentioned Eau Claire earlier, and that made me think, you know, obviously Wisconsin has borders, and most of those borders have freeways going across them. What happens when we believe the missing child has gone out of state?
Well, we have a cooperative relationship with our bordering states in our Amber Alert program, so we have a mechanism set up that we'll be able to reach out to each one of our bordering states fairly quickly and be able to request an Amber Alert through those states. If they go beyond our bordering states, we have relationships with law enforcement in each of those states as well, where we can reach out and request that they issue an Amber Alert. And so while we have our criteria that I had previously described, most states have criteria very similar. However, if we issue an Amber Alert in Wisconsin and we believe that the child has gone to another state, it's not an automatic activation in another state. Each state has their own Amber Alert program and their own criteria that, while they're similar, it may not qualify for an Amber Alert in another state.
Jennifer Price, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us this morning. Jennifer Price is commander of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Child Abduction Response Team. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Lake Superior is the largest of the Great Lakes and the second largest body of fresh water in the world. Researchers and officials are meeting this week in Ashland to consider a plan for the future of Lake Superior, with a focus on clean land and water. We'll find out about the goals and challenges involved with this effort. What do you want to be done to protect land and water quality in the Lake Superior Basin? How do you want the community to be involved? Let us know, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Valerie Dempstra is a natural resources educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension and is based in Ashland. Valerie, thank you for joining us.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me.
Talk to us about the Lake Superior Collaborative Symposium. Who attends this and why?
Sure. Well, Lake Superior Collaborative Symposium started yesterday, will be concluding today, and it's a gathering of primarily natural resource professionals that are working in the Wisconsin's portion of the Lake Superior Basin to protect and restore the land and the water of the basin. So we have a group of folks from the state, federal, tribal agencies, local governments, the nonprofits in the area that are working on watershed issues, and we are trying to work in a coordinated effort to make sure that we all know and understand what's going on, and that we know who's doing what work in what places, and how we can best work together and be most efficient with our work and also with the dollars that we have to spend on this.
Is this a symposium a regular event, or is this the first one?
Well, it's the first one that we're calling the Lake Superior Collaborative, but there have been sort of different iterations of partnerships in our part of the world over the last several years. So a previous iteration was called the Shawamigan Bay Partnership, and so we've held two previous symposiums under that umbrella. And now we're starting to sort of broaden our reach a little bit more to cover more of the whole swath of Wisconsin's portion of the basin.
Part of your conversation at this symposium included changes in conditions in the Lake Superior watershed, which I don't think most people understand how really small that watershed is. Share a few of those changes with us.
Well, I think that people maybe are seeing those changes. I mean, I think one of the biggest things that we're seeing and the things that we've talked about a lot are the more frequent intense storm events that have been happening. If you are in the Duluth area, you probably remember the storm from 2012. In 2016 and 2018, there were portions of Douglas, Ashland, and Bayfield counties that were devastated by the flooding. And the result of that is we get road washouts, we get culverts blowing out, bridges are blowing out, landscapes are being flooded, wind events are blowing trees down. So it's really changing, changing how, as natural resource managers, we're thinking about how are we helping to protect and restore the land and water in the basin, because the conditions that were present, you know, even 10 years ago are very different now. And this is something that we are feeling is not going to change or go away. And so we have to start thinking about how do we adjust and adapt to these new conditions as we move forward.
And this most recent storm, we actually saw coastal flooding in Duluth, which is something that, and I've lived near Lake Superior for most of my life. I don't remember ever seeing that more than once in, say, 50 years, and we saw it just recently. So a lot of things seem to be changing in our weather and the way the lake reacts to it. We're talking with Valerie Damstra, natural resources educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension, who is based in Ashland, where researchers and officials are meeting this week to consider and plan for the future of Lake Superior with a focus on clean land and water. What do you want to be done to protect land and water quality in the Lake Superior Basin? How do you want the community to be involved? Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or on Twitter. It's at WPR Mornings. Let's talk some more about those extreme storms and the flooding we've seen. How did all of that displaced sediment impact the lake? And what about the basin overall?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, for those of us who live in Ashland and in the Shawamigan Bay area, you know, it's not uncommon to see after a storm event, see the bay turn brown or red. There are reasons for that. The soil types that are in the Shawamigan Bay region are a mixture of sand and clay, and so they are very highly erodible to begin with. And we're still seeing erosion effects from the logging cutover that was about 100 years ago. We're recovering from that, but we're still seeing some of those effects from that even today. But now with these extreme weather events where we're getting more frequent storms and much more higher amounts of rain in shorter amounts of time, that's exacerbating those conditions. And so particularly for us in Shawamigan Bay and around the Bayfield Peninsula, we're seeing, the bay turn brown, and it's taking a lot longer for that sediment to dissipate because there's just so much of it. We're seeing nutrients that are getting washed into the lake, and so we're seeing presence of harmful algal blooms around Cornucopia and around the Apostle Islands, which we didn't see before. Those are a couple of examples of things that have changed that we just haven't really had on our radar in the last few years, but there are things that we need to learn more about and learn and try to figure out what the effects are going to be in the long term and how do we help mitigate that.
How do you adapt to this as a natural resource community?
Well, that's a great question. So there are one of the things that is we're finding very valuable, particularly with this symposium, is that, you know, it's an opportunity to bring people together who are taking a look at this from all different angles. And there are some really talented researchers and people developing tools to help us with what we're calling climate change adaptation. So We have a presentation coming up today with somebody from the Northern Institute of Applied Climate Science based out of Houghton, Michigan, and they've developed some tools to help recommend different types of applications to the land with these changing landscapes. And so it's basically, we have to sort of change the framework. Some of the practices that we've done, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago aren't necessarily going to be the things that work today. That's why we need to get together and try to figure out as a group, you know, what should we be doing? And there's a lot of work that's helping guide us that way, but there is still a lot that's unknown. And but the only way that we're going to be able to tackle this is through this collaborative effort.
And what would success look like here?
Success. I mean, I think something for us that we've been working with in the Chemung Bay for a long time is really trying to reduce that amount of sediment that's going into the bay. But, you know, we would love to see the bay less brown, less frequently. But I think what's most important for us is we want to make sure that we are helping to protect our water quality, not only for the sake of the ecosystem, but for public health. You know, we want to see less beach closures. We want to see less algal blooms that could be harmful. We want to help local managers or local officials figure out how to make their infrastructure more stable so that they're not having to deal with culverts blowing out every time we get a big rain. So there's more implications than just the ecological benefit of the lake. But if our success can also contribute to public health benefits, local government benefits, local official benefits, and citizen benefits, ultimately, that's mm-hmm. really what we're going for.
And we're going to talk about all of that stuff as our conversation continues, Valerie. You mentioned algae blooms a couple of times. We're hearing more about that, nutrients eroding into the lake causing this. Why are these harmful, and what can be done to prevent them?
Well, one of the reasons that they can be harmful is there are certain types of algae that contain toxins that can be dangerous for public health. If somebody gets ingests the algae while they're swimming, it can be really toxic. What we're seeing so far, though, the preliminary research is that the green algae blooms that we're seeing that have been popping up around Cornucopia and sort of in that Apostle Islands area do not contain those toxins at this point, but that doesn't mean that that there isn't potential for that in the future. We want to try to be proactive.
Okay, well, let's talk about how to prevent them in just a moment. Valerie Damstra is a natural resources educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension based in Ashland. We want to hear from you about what you think needs to be done to protect land and water quality in the Lake Superior Basin. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Researchers and officials are meeting this week in Ashland to consider a plan for the future of Lake Superior with a focus on clean land and water. We're talking about the goals and challenges involved with this effort. What do you want to be done to protect land and water quality in the Lake Superior Basin? How do you want the community to be involved? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Valerie Damstra is a natural resources educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension based in Ashland, and she's here to talk to us about this today. Valerie, where we're talking about algae, and we know how it gets there. We know how it can be harmful. What can we do to prevent it happening more frequently?
Well, that's one of the things that researchers are trying to sort of figure out. So there's not only the issue of, trying to reduce the amount of the phosphorus that's getting into the lake to, you know, which is sort of what feeds the algae. But we also need to figure out what is the source of the algae. Where is it coming from? Is it actually in the lake itself, or is it coming from the streams that are draining into the lake? And we're not exactly sure about that yet. Because what's really interesting about the algae blooms is that Lake Superior is not a place where you would typically think this would happen because of how cold the water is. But there are, you know, with the changing weather patterns, water temperatures are rising, and so it's starting to create this environment for algae where we didn't used to see it before. Now, what's sort of interesting, too, is that, the Shawangan Bay area is a lot warmer in the bay, and there are nutrients and sediment coming into the bay with these storm events as well, but we're not seeing algae blooms in that area. And we think the reason for that is because of the amount of sediment is actually kind of like turning the lights out, because algae is a plant, right? So it needs sunlight to help grow. So with that sedimentation and the brown water, it's not allowing those conditions for the algae to proliferate in the bay at this point. So that's a really interesting thing that researchers are sort of taking a look at.
Let's take a phone call. James is with us from Wakefield, Michigan. James, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, and thank you. I live in Wakefield, Michigan. We're about 40 miles east of Ashland, about 17 miles inland from Lake Superior. I'm totally in love with Lake Superior, spend as much time as possible on the lake, and I think there's something that every citizen can do, and that's just simply do not litter. There's so much litter on the ground. We have a lake in our town. Obviously, it all ends up in Lake Superior eventually in the plastic, the styrofoam, and my real pet peeve, cigarette butts. It just drives me crazy when I'm out running around, walking around the lake, picking up especially the cigarette butts. People, something that every person can do, do not litter. And think about our Lake Superior when we do this.
James, thank you for sharing that with us. Valerie, James, with a practical suggestion for everybody who's walking around, pick something up and throw it away, or, you know, don't leave it on the ground to begin with.
Absolutely. And James, thank you so much. And, you know, it's good to hear that you love Lake Superior. That's why we live here. Love Lake is really one of the touchstones of our community. So I think that's a great practical suggestion. And, you know, I would encourage folks to, you know, tune in with, you know, what are your local nonprofit organizations working on? There are groups like there's the Superior Rivers Watershed Association based out of Ashland, but they cover the Douglas, Bayfield, Ashland, and Iron counties, and they help to organize roadside cleanups. I know in the city of Ashland, we organize a couple times a year beach cleanups to help clean up that debris and cigarette butts off the beach. So, there are opportunities out there for citizens to get involved in an organized way. But, yeah, simply just if you're out, take a trash bag and help pick up. That's awesome. So thanks.
Let's talk a little bit about the conference. There are a few speakers at the conference talking about wetlands. Why are wetlands so important?
Wetlands are amazing. So, one of the issues that I mentioned is, you know, we've got this, even before we started kind of dealing with these more extreme rain events, is that we do have a problem with sedimentation and erosion into the Shawangan Bay in particular because of the erodible soils. And so one of the mantras that we have in our natural resource community around here is we call it slow the flow. And so what that means is that if we can slow the runoff, so the rain comes down, hits the land, and then runs off and heads to the nearest stream. If we can slow that flow to the stream, therefore we can reduce the sediment and the erosion that's happening downstream. And wetlands play an amazing role in that. If we can conserve wetlands, restore wetlands in the right places on the landscape, they can be a tremendous benefit to holding a place to hold that water, and it keeps it holds it on the landscape, and then allows it to slowly release into the stream rather than getting that whole deluge all at once. And so they're a really tremendous tool for us. Okay. When we're thinking about slowing the flow and reducing erosion.
Valerie Dempster, so much more to talk about here, but we are up against a time crunch. Valerie, so much to do. Valerie Dempster, natural resources educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension based in Ashland. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Wisconsin's voter turnout in the last election was as low as it's been for any presidential contest in the past 16 years, and predominantly black neighborhoods in Milwaukee reported some of the biggest declines. If history is any guide, even more will stay home for the upcoming midterm election. Hemina Condi reports on efforts in Milwaukee's black community to change that.
Derek Etherly is one of several canvassers going door-to-door in a predominantly black neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side. He's never done this before.
I'm a member of Community of Grace Baptist Church representing Souls to the Polls.
Etherly is working with a group called Souls to the Polls that recruits canvassers at churches.
Are you aware of the election that's November 6th?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sometimes it's an easy sales pitch. The woman at this house tells Etherly she always votes.
November 6th then. All right, thank you.
Other times, canvassers have their work cut out for them. One of the people they pass is 34-year-old Derek Montgomery.
I did vote 2012. I did not vote in 2014. I am the problem.
And you didn't vote in 2016?
No, I did not vote in 2016 either.
Montgomery says he won't vote because he doesn't think it will make a difference.
I feel like it's they got their own little thing that they want to do, their own agenda that they got going, and that's what they're going to push no matter who's in office.
City election data shows a 14 percentage point drop in voter turnout in this neighborhood between the 2012 and 2016 election. Anita Johnson, who leads canvassing efforts for Souls to the Polls, blames a couple factors. 2016 was the first election requiring voter ID in Wisconsin. Johnson said that created confusion.
Some people think you need a voter ID card instead of a driver's license or a state ID.
Johnson thinks the 2016 candidates for president also played a role.
Other people just didn't like the candidates that were running, so they felt like, well, I'm not gonna vote.
That could have played a factor with 29-year-old Remington Duke. As two young canvassers with a youth organization approach Duke, he applauds their work but says he won't be voting. Duke says the only politician he remembers casting a ballot for is former President Barack Obama.
I just really don't care who's governor, who's president, who's none of that. Like, oh yeah, it was a hoo-ah for Barack because he was so-called black, you know what I'm saying? But besides that, I wouldn't care.
Duke says he's busy trying to support his family. He feels whether Democrats or Republicans hold office, his best shot at seeing change in government as a black man is to leave the state.
By me voting is not going to help. You know what I mean? I need to stay focused on whatever I'm doing and how I'm going to eat, how my kids going to eat, how I'm going to pay these bills.
History suggests turnout will be even lower in the upcoming midterm election than it was in 2016. Races for governor and U.S. Senate don't get as much attention as races for president. Advocates like Johnson say they're not discouraged. And first-time canvasser Derek Etherly says it's his job to get others to believe their vote matters.
A lot of times people think that their votes don't count. But if everybody thought that way, then we would have no one voting.
While elections officials say it's hard to make predictions about turnout among specific demographics, advocates do see a sign for hope. Milwaukee saw a higher than usual turnout in this year's August primary. Organizers are working to continue that trend in November. Hemina Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For additional coverage leading up to the election or to check out candidate interviews, visit wisconsinvote.org.